Previously on Beta.
You're gonna clean glass?
I don't wanna clean glass, I just wanna get down alive!
You wanna look like you just came back from catching a fish? This thing dances with salmon, you know?
Come out and shake it, you dirty yellow-bellied rat, or I'll give it to you through the door!
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, Stephen Graham Jones joins us to talk about his horror novel, The Only Good Indians, and how it deals with Native identity.
America wants us to be in a John Wayne movie, basically. They want us wearing headbands and loincloths and falling dead off the back of horses. That's not necessarily what we want, of course.
Also, film critic Glenn Kenny on Martin Scorsese's 1990 mobster epic, Goodfellas.
The How Am I Funny scene came out of conversations that Scorsese had with Joe Pesci. Pesci talks about seeing a scene like that unfold in real life.
But first, have you ever thought that some of the movies you've watched reminded you of events that happened in your own life? Sharon Dolan certainly has. She's a poet and an essayist. Sharon's the author of 6 poetry collections, and she's also written Hitchcock Blonde, a cinematic memoir. The book explores her life through the lens of 10 of Alfred Hitchcock's films. Here's Sharon reading an excerpt.
Summertime in the Catskills with my family at one of the Borscht Belt hotels. I think it must have been the Pines. I'm quite young, no more than 4 or 5, alone in the day camp arts and crafts hut. How can this have happened? I'm looping a potholder onto its frame, so intent on weaving together the red, blue, and yellow bands that I do not notice at first when my mother comes in to retrieve me. Instead of taking me back to the hotel where my father and sister are waiting to meet us, Mommy pulls me by the hand and we run into the woods in back of the hotel property. Farther and farther we fly, through the woods, past the occasional house. Where is she taking me? It may seem strange to write that my mother used to kidnap me, but that is what it felt like.
Why did you want to explore your life through the lens of Alfred Hitchcock's films?
I will say, like any writer, I didn't choose Alfred Hitchcock. Alfred Hitchcock chose me. I did not think I was going to write a memoir. And then I was actually ill with the flu. We all know about being feverish, especially in these COVID days. And I was running about 103, 104 fever. And I thought I would watch Vertigo.
Give me your hand.
And I was just coming down off of a very destructive affair. And I was watching the movie and I thought to myself, Eureka, this could work. This is so connected to what I was going through in this relationship. So it's really about destructive heterosexual desire. And I thought I could possibly write a memoir through the lens of Hitchcock. And I took a number of months in order to figure out that I could do it. Pasteur says, chance favors the prepared mind. And so my mind in its feverish haze was prepared.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The dictionary defines Hitchcockian as, quote, resembling the style of Sir Alfred Hitchcock, especially through the use of tension and suspense, end quote. So would it be fair to say that your life has contained a lot of tension and suspense?
Yes. I would say very little has turned out the way I would have predicted. From the time I was a small child. Again, I trusted my mother. I loved my mother. And yet she did things that were frightening, like running away with me. Or when she would have a breakdown, she seemed to become another person. Or when she had disappearances, I didn't understand them entirely when she went into the hospital or when she came back and she was so drugged up, I didn't really recognize her. So I would say from the get-go, everything in my life seemed to be unpredictable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, your mother had schizophrenia and your father was a traveling salesman. So can you talk a bit about what your relationships were like with your parents?
I loved them. They loved me. They adored me. And so I think it's very important in this book to understand that you can have a parent who's severely mentally ill. And yet I got the most important thing from her I could get, which was her really unconditional love, even though it was at times very frightening. And the same, I think, was true of my father, whom I had to depend on, even though there was something rather childish about him and also unreliable. And he would go on these road trips for a month or more at a time, and we would be left with my mother, and who knows what would happen with her when he was away. And that is eventually why he put her on medication, or had her put on medication permanently.
Yeah. What was the first Hitchcock film you saw that really connected with your personal life?
I think as a child, the one that I remember watching and my favorite one is Rear Window. And again, as I was putting together this book, I thought to myself, Rear Window, here he is, the voyeur, looking in on other people's lives. And when I was growing up in Brooklyn, we had windows. We lived on the first floor of a rental, and people could look in our windows. So I very much had that experience of other people spying on me. I could read that very brief section that happened, yeah, which was really quite frightening at the time.
Yeah, please do. Thank you.
This happens in Brooklyn. I lived in East Flatbush, and I was a teenager at the time. I was in high school. Let's say I was about 16. I'm reclining on my bed, one leg bent akimbo over the other, chatting away with a friend when I hear a rapping on the side door to our apartment. Our dog McDuff, a Bedlington Terrier, starts barking, and I come out of my bedroom to stand at one end of the kitchen. It is rare for us to have an evening visitor. Our next-door neighbor, who has the strange mother with the bottom of her face missing, is standing at the entrance to our kitchen with a red-headed teenage boy about my age in front of him. I see that the boy is shaking. I caught this boy peeping in your back window. What do you want me to do with him? As I move closer to the doorway, I see that our neighbor, wearing a red plaid hunting jacket, has the barrel of a shotgun prodding the boy's back. I have never seen a shotgun before. I stand there transfixed. The boy, tall and freckled, looks into my father's face, trembling, silently pleading for his life. Shoot him, my dad says. No, please, the boy cries out. Get lost, my neighbor says as he lowers the gun. And if I ever see you around here again, I won't hesitate to use this. The boy gives him a quick nod and runs off. And I realize that the boy had been looking in my window while I was talking on the phone. I had this issue a lot of my life of feeling that there were people who were looking in on me. And of course, the quandary of writing this book was I was allowing people to look in on my life, and I was having to deal with what that meant.
Mm-hmm. And there's that famous scene in Rear Window in which James Stewart's character, L.B. Jeffries, asks Grace Kelly's character, Lisa Fremont, if she thinks it's ethical for him to stare at his neighbor through his camera, even if he proves that he didn't see his neighbor commit a crime. And Lisa replies,
I'm not much on Rear Window ethics.
Of course, they can do the same thing to me, watch me like a bug under a glass if they want to.
Jeff, you know, if someone came in here, they wouldn't believe what they'd see.
What?
You and me with long faces, plunged into despair because we find out a man didn't kill his wife. We're two of the most frightening ghouls I've ever known.
How did you wrestle with this ethical issue while writing your memoir?
It's a disturbing one. I've always felt that to be a writer, you have to be somewhat ruthless. Believe it or not, I learned this from the most misogynist of artists, from Picasso. And that doesn't mean there weren't things I left out of the memoir to protect certain people. But for the most part, I felt I had to tell my story. I did feel there was the ethical quandary of having to reveal certain things about my dad that I had only found out at the end of his life. And I was very troubled by having to reveal the fact that he had had affairs. That was something I didn't know for my whole life while he was alive, really not until the very end of his life. But I think in order to write this memoir, I had to decide that it was more important for me to speak my truth, whatever that truth is. And again, it's going to be different for somebody else. My sister has called me up and said, oh no, that's not how I remember it happening. So everybody has a different version of the past.
Mm-hmm. The whole Rashomon thing. Yeah, truth is in the eye of the beholder. Yeah. Hitchcock sexually harassed many of the leading ladies in his films, especially Tippi Hedren, who starred in The Birds. She has said that Hitchcock's behavior ruined her career. I'm curious about how this affects this bad behavior by Hitchcock, how it affects the way you view him and his films, especially in terms of the ways that the films relate to your own life.
I very early on have made a distinction between the biographical figure of the artist and their work. What interested me was that he really was the most abusive and stepped over the line with Tippi Hedren. I think it was partially a class issue because she was very working class. He wouldn't dare to do that, I don't believe, with Ingrid Bergman or Grace Kelly, but he felt he could get away with it with Tippi Hedren. And I think it affected the Bergs. I think in that final scene where she goes upstairs and is attacked, she's almost blinded by the Bergs. And I think that he was getting out his sexual rage at her for refusing him in the movie itself. And it's very disturbing to see that.
Melanie!
And of course, this is the one movie where I was actually sexually assaulted myself while watching the movie for the first time.
Ooh, yeah. You have a chapter about, my favorite Hitchcock film and also my all-time favorite film, Vertigo. It's called What Do Men and Women Want? What is the connection between Vertigo and the time in your life that you associate with it?
It's up until the present. It is the various relationships that I had in which it seemed that the men wanted to control me or make me over into some cipher of their own desire. And I wanted to be desired and would do so at any cost. And I think that's really what happens in Vertigo. It goes to an extreme, of course. But I think that my own relationships seem to rhyme with the ones that are in Vertigo. And I was sort of shocked when I first was aware of that. For instance, I was in a relationship with somebody who had been involved with another poet who had committed suicide. And then this man sent me a short poem by text that seemed as though it was addressed to me, but it was actually addressed to her. So he was in love with the dead woman and was really conflating me with her. How close to Vertigo can you get?
Not any closer, I don't think. How is writing this book, this cinematic memoir, how has it changed your life?
As I say somewhere in here, it means I have had to learn, or I am continuing to have to learn, how to live life with the shades up, which is not to say that I'm an exhibitionist. I don't feel that way. But I have had to accept that people are going to know intimate details about my life that they did not know. Even though I have been writing poems, some of which you could say were confessional, there is always the scrim of metaphor and the language in poetry. Of course, I use Hitchcock in a similar way, and you could say I use him as a shield and also as a lens through which to view my life. I will also say that I probably have tampered with my memories or altered them for good. Once you retrieve a memory, and you see it in terms of something else, it's very hard to unsee it that way. So I think now it's very hard for me to remember these incidents from my past without thinking of Hitchcock and the movies associated with them. So I've sort of permanently altered these memories. I could not have done it with another director. Absolutely not. I do think that I see my life differently. And I did come to some realizations that I would not have had I not written this memoir.
For example?
I would say, for instance, in this Bellbound chapter, when I was in love with someone who was very addicted to cocaine, I deal with this issue of addiction in here, and he hid it from me and everybody, and he would have these psychotic breaks. I don't think I understood when I was going through it that what drew me to him was that the psychotic breaks when he was on cocaine or in withdrawal from it were very similar to the kinds of breaks that my mother would have. And that even though it was terrifying to me, he would threaten to let me out of the side of the road in the middle of the night. I guess there was something comforting and familiar about it. And as I write in that chapter, it was a way to keep my mother alive because she died shortly after he and I began seeing each other. So perhaps seeing him and staying with him, despite his being dangerous for me, I realized this pattern that I had not realized before I began writing the book.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a moment ago that one of the ways your life has changed by writing your book was that you've permanently altered some memories. I'm curious about how you feel about that emotionally. Are you sad that you've permanently altered them? Does it matter to you?
Actually, I'm very happy about it because I write at the very end, I talk about trying to create something beautiful. And I feel if that is what I've been able to do with this pain, that's what all artists want to do. It's what Dante talks about, the refining fire of poetry and of prose. I've tried with my art to create something beautiful out of all of this pain. And I hope that's what I've achieved. So actually I'm, to the extent that this project is a success, I'm pleased that I was able to transform all of this pain with the help of Hitchcock into something that has a beauty to it.
Mm-hmm. I think it does. It certainly did for me. Sharon Dolan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sharon Dolan is a poet and the author of Hitchcock Blonde, a cinematic memoir. You can find out more about Sharon at wpr.org/beta.
We're definitely trying to fight for, number one, just existence, because so many people don't understand that American Indians still exist.
Novelist Stephen Graham Jones talks about his novel, The Only Good Indians. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Whoa, whoa, Lewis said to her, feeling more than seeing Cass's rifle plunk into the snow just short of his right leg. He felt down for it, that young elk still struggling, blowing red mist from her nostrils, her eyes so big, so deep, so shiny. And I couldn't find a shell, Lewis says to Shaney. I thought I was out, that I'd used my last up by the truck when everything was crazy. But you had one, Shaney tells him. Two, Lewis says back, looking down at his hands. This close, he didn't need the scope or a sight. Sorry, girl, he said, and, careful of his swelling up eye, lined the barrel up, pulled the trigger.
That's a reading from author Stephen Graham Jones' horror novel, The Only Good Indians. Stephen is a pretty prolific author. With 22 books under his belt, most of them in the horror genre, you could almost say that he makes Stephen King look like a slacker. Almost. In The Only Good Indians, Stephen Graham Jones blends a gripping and intense classic horror narrative about regret and revenge with a social commentary about Native identity. It's a perfect example of why he is now being dubbed the Jordan Peele of horror literature. We caught up with Stephen over Zoom to talk about the novel and what he thinks of that moniker.
I think it's because I know horror really well. I do horror, but also I bring who I am into the story, onto the page. And I'm not quite happy with the way things are as regards the treatment or representation of American Indians. And so I'm always coming at that, as well as my characters are coming at a monster or a monster is coming at them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Your latest novel is called The Only Good Indians. Can you tell us a little bit about the storyline?
Yeah. The story is four guys up on the Blackfeet Reservation are out after elk one day just before Thanksgiving. And they make a mistake in the field. They do something they shouldn't have done. And it's just another day in the field for them, more or less, until 10 years later, it turns out that something from that day is now hunting them.
Yeah. Well, why did you choose the elk as the animal which haunts the memories of these young men?
I guess the first reason is because their atrocity, their crime, the trespass they committed wasn't against a single animal, it was against a herd of animals. And you don't very often in November come upon a whole herd of deer or whitetail or mule deer, you will find elk bunched up together like that. So, I mean, part of it's just mechanical or logistical. But, you know, the real reason, it's probably just that since I was 12, I've been hunting elk. And when we go out for elk, we usually have mule deer and whitetail tags too, but elk is the goat. And elk are super sneaky, super smart, super fast, super tough. When you get an elk, it's only after a lot of hard work. And that to me makes them kind of special.
Is another part of the reason that elk are the goal is also because they're bigger and so you're getting more meat?
You are getting a lot more meat, yes.
Mm. How much of your own personal experience hunting elk migrated into the minds of your characters?
All of it. Since I've been hunting elk my whole life, then these guys are basically doing what I've been doing.
Yeah. Your four main characters, Ricky, Lewis, Gabriel, and Cassidy, have this inside joke about which of their actions are actions that are worthy of a good Indian. And this raises the question, what makes a good Indian? What do you think the answer is?
You know, I wanted everybody in this novel to be asking themselves that. What does it mean to be a good Indian in today's world? Because America wants us to be in a John Wayne movie, basically. They want us wearing headbands and loincloths and falling dead off the back of horses. That's not necessarily what we want, of course. We're always like struggling between the representation that's forced on us and who we want to be. And there's also situations where success in one culture is betrayal in another culture. And there's all kinds of dynamics like that, which can grind a person up. So where I wanted to land with this question, what makes a good Indian, is that there's not a single way to be a good Indian. There's 7 million different ways. And the reason there's 7 million different ways is because there's 7 million of us and growing.
Are the qualities that make a good Indian different from the qualities that make a good man of any culture?
No, I don't really think they are. No, it's not about adherence to tradition. It's not about observance of ceremony. It's not about who you marry. It's about none of that. It is about whether you kind of measure up to your own threshold for success. I think that's finally what makes a good person. And to me, that's what makes a good Indian too.
Mm-hmm, yeah. I was very intrigued by the way your four main characters in the novel, the way they imagine newspaper headlines about themselves when they're under a lot of pressure. For example, the very first sentence is, the headline for Richard Boss Ribs would be Indian man killed in dispute outside bar. And then the second last sentence also references headlines. What role do these recurring headlines play in your novel?
I feel like I've always heard headlines in my life, so it's really just me doing like autobiography, I guess. But the way I imagine these headlines is this is the stereotypes or set of expectations that every Indian hears as she or he moves through their life, especially with Lewis, who's probably has the most headlines, I would guess. He's always asking himself, how do I measure up? And he's always finding that the headlines are announcing that he fails, you know, that he's not doing a good enough job.
Mm-hmm. What was the biggest challenge you faced while writing The Only Good Indians?
The biggest challenge was hopping heads, going from point of view to point of view, because we're both in the Spirit of Vengeance's point of view. We're in all of the characters' heads as well. There's definitely a few characters. When you watch a slasher, when you go to see Jason or Michael or Freddy at the movie theater or streaming or wherever, there's always that moment where you're looking through the eye holes of the character's mask, or you're parting the bushes to look at the party going on. I always call that slasher cam. It's where we kind of understand that this breathing presence is stalking someone. It's a, you know, a scary thing, of course. It does a good thing to up the tension in the story. However, on the page in fiction, it's really tricky to do that because we're taught that each section gets its own point of view. You can't mix them. And so to jump heads, you have to do a different section or a chapter break. But to do that announces what you're doing, and the point of view can no longer scare the character. And so I had to drop into what feels like second person from third person, which was a trick. And finally, instead of like asking for permission or precedence to do it, I just figured I'm just going to do it, make it work.
Mm-hmm. And you certainly did. I think it worked very well. It was very effective.
Thank you.
You've said that you really only write in one genre, and that genre is called What Would I Like to Read? But besides the what Stephen Graham Jones would like to readiness of this book, there's a lot of horror you're dealing with, because that's something you explore in a lot of your novels. And you're also dealing with big themes like revenge and cultural identity. What, if anything, were you trying to do different with this novel?
You know, in this novel, I wanted to to scare people. That's always, I think, as a horror writer, that's got to be your first goal, is to scare people. So that was the threshold I kept asking myself of each scene, each development, each turn, was, is this going to keep the reader off balance enough that I can then like push them over a precipice into a dark space? That was, of course, my very first thing. And you know, my second expectation I always put on my own work is I don't want to do any damage. I don't necessarily want to like repair things, but I don't want to break anything. It's kind of like a Boy Scout thing. I don't want to leave a place any more messed up than it was.
The Tuscarora writer Alicia Elliott has written about the rise of this genre called indigenous horror. And she says that this genre finds indigenous writers weaving them in the mundane horror of living in a country that dehumanizes them with fiction designed to scare readers and audiences. Do you see your work as fitting into this genre?
Yeah, no, I think it definitely does. All Indians who are doing art in the post-apocalypse, where we're definitely trying to fight for, number one, just existence, because so many people don't understand that American Indians still exist. You know, they think that we went away when with covered wagons or whatever. So that's the first battle. And then the second battle is for, it's not for fair or charitable representation, I don't think. I think that's a distraction. I think it's for treaty rights, for legal stuff. You know, I think sovereignty, we need to be, that's the stuff that we always need to be angling for or looking towards.
Mm-hmm. Do you have hope that more progress will be made towards sovereignty?
I do have hope. Like that decision that was just made in Oklahoma that returned so much of the land, that's a major, major step. And I think it's going to ripple out to a lot more decisions and things are going to slowly start to change. And if I remember correctly, a pipeline was recently denied access to some tribal lands. And that kind of stuff just thrills me to no end.
There's this shift-shaping creature called Elkhead Woman that stalks the four men. Does this character originate in Native American mythology, or is it something that you invented?
There is a deer woman, but I didn't plan on Elkhead Woman continuing that tradition necessarily. Or if it does, it's only in the sense that right before I was writing The Only Good Indians, I had a friend, Elizabeth LaPensee, I had one of her comic books right here by my keyboard, and on her comic book is called Deer Woman, a vignette, and on the cover is a woman with a deer head. And so I can't imagine that that didn't influence me and make me imagine Elkhead Woman. However, really what I was trying to do with Elkhead Woman is just bring Jason Voorhees up to the reservation and see how that kind of slasher would fare against us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you certainly did that and did it in a very gripping and very scary way. What is it about slasher fiction and in film and in literature that you find so interesting?
What I like about the slasher is that wrongs are punished. And I'm not talking about wrongs like drinking, drugs, sex, partying, any of that. Like that's a weird thing that's happened. I'm talking about treating people with compassion. Like the way the slasher is usually built is, in sixth grade, a group of popular kids take advantage of a unpopular kid and shame him or her in the cafeteria of the school or something. And they just move on with their day. This was another bullying incident of many that they've, you know, done. However, 10 years later at the graduation or high school reunion or whatever it is, they are then made to pay for their crimes, either by a spirit of vengeance having risen as a result of that or by that very victim empowering themselves to come back and get justice. And that's what I love about the slasher, is that those kind of wrongs are punished. Like in the real world, you know, we all see in the news in our daily lives, we see terrible stuff happening every day and it's not punished. You know, there's no closure of that justice cycle. On the page in a slasher or on screen in a slasher, I can for a moment believe that the world is a fair place.
Yeah, very well said. You have this great essay that you wrote, I'm not sure when, a few years ago anyway, called Letter to a Just Starting Out Indian Writer, and Maybe to Myself. And in this essay you write, don't ask for permission, but don't ask for forgiveness either. You're going to say things you wished you hadn't or that you wished you'd said better. It makes me wonder, have you ever written something that you regret that you wish you could take back?
Years ago, I did a introduction for a collection of things. And in the introduction, I mention all the different nationalities that are represented in this collection that I was, you know, talking about. And I always feel bad that somewhere in there I said I'd never heard of some of these places, because I hadn't. I thought I was being honest. And I mean, it's not bad to be honest, but at the same time, I wonder if I was from that small country in Sri Lanka or wherever it is, and I was reading that, how like disempowered would I feel knowing that somebody else did not know about my home country? And so probably like once a week in the past like 12, 13 years since I did that, I think about that and I just cringe, like I should have been better.
You also say that a good question to keep in mind while writing is, who are you writing against? So I want to ask you that. Who are you writing against in your work?
Yeah, I mean, I'm writing against people who produce fiction that's not sincere. That's my first straw man I put up. I don't consider a straw man. I consider it a quite scary meat person. I think insincere fiction pulls the whole house of fiction down. Stuff that people are writing solely for money, that they don't put their heart into, that doesn't matter to them, that just, it hurts my soul to imagine that stuff like that is on the shelf, that a reader can go to a store or a friend or wherever and pick a book off the shelf and want an experience and get something that someone didn't put their heart in. That just makes me sad.
Yeah. I understand that you create a playlist for every novel that you write. What was on your playlist for the only Good Indians?
I can't remember. I do create a playlist for all my novels. Usually I save them. Somehow I did not save my Only Good Indians playlist.
You don't find that distracting, like to hear lyrics while you're writing, while you're creating words to hear lyrics of songs?
No, I'm actually, the playlist I create have to have lyrics. I've tried instrumental pieces and I listen to those too closely. But if I choose songs that I know so intimately that I no longer have to listen to them, but I still have like emotional associations with them. Like an example would be, let's see, Meatloaf, Objects in the Rearview Mirror. That finds its way onto a lot of my playlists. And I've listened to that song probably thousands of times, so I no longer have to listen to it. But once I hear it, it provokes or pulls out the same emotions from me. And those emotions are what I need for the playlist. Also, if there's words, then that does distract a part of my mind, which I consider to be the critical part of my mind, so that I can actually do some real work. Because if you're always looking over your own shoulder, imagining what are the critics going to think, what is this reader going to think, what is history going to think, then you don't actually move forward. You get too nervous. You can't write with all that attention. I think you have to write your first draft with your heart, and then you go back with your brain and revise it and make it work. But that first draft, for it to be pure, you can't have anybody looking over your shoulder, I don't think.
Stephen Graham Jones, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stephen Graham Jones is the author of the horror novel, The Only Good Indians. You can find out more about Stephen at wpr.org/beta.
It does say something, I think, about the kind of mutated version of the American dream that being a mobster represents.
Coming up next, we celebrate the 30th anniversary of Martin Scorsese's mob masterpiece, Goodfellas, with film critic Glenn Kenny. That's after this. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. This is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
You know, we always called each other good fellas. Like you'd say to somebody, you're gonna like this guy, he's all right. He's a good fella, he's one of us. You understand? We were good fellas, wise guys.
That's Ray Liotta as gangster turned informant Henry Hill from Martin Scorsese's 1990 masterpiece, Goodfellas. 30 years later, it's still considered by many to be the greatest mob movie ever made. The picture is based on crime writer Nicholas Pileggi's exhilarating expose of Hill and mob life called Wise Guy. Glenn Kenny is a film critic whose work appears in the New York Times and on RogerEbert.com. He's also the author of Made Men, The Story of Goodfellas. Glenn spoke with nearly all of the principals involved in the film, and he echoes Pileggi's claim that the book or the movie wouldn't have been possible if not for the natural storytelling charisma of Henry Hill.
Any journalist who met Henry Hill would consider him a gift because he loved to talk and he had amazing stories and he spoke coherently. And the thing about him, I think he was introduced to Nick Pileggi by Ed McDonald, the prosecutor who plays himself in Goodfellas. And Pileggi and Hill hit it off, and Hill just wanted to talk. You know, he broke free of his FBI handler at the time he met Pileggi and gave Pileggi a number that his FBI handler, a phone number that his FBI handler would not have been happy for him to give Pileggi. And that started the relationship. And that started the book, you know, as Henry Hill's son, Greg Hill, puts it in his own book with his sister Gina on the run. Henry always had an angle. So to be approached by a journalist who says, do you want to do a book together? The first thing that occurs to Henry is the angle, which is money.
This is really funny. Really funny. What do you mean I'm funny? It's funny, you know. It's a good story. It's funny. You're a funny guy.
What do you mean? You mean the way I talk? What?
Just, you know, you're just funny. It's, you know, the way you tell the story and everything.
Funny how? I mean, what's funny about it?
Tommy, no, you got it all wrong.
Anthony. He's a big boy. He knows what he said. What'd you say?
You're right.
Funny how? What?
Just, you know, you're funny.
I'm funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown. I amuse you. I make you laugh. What do you mean funny? Funny how? How am I funny?
No, just, you know how you tell a story. What?
No, I don't know. You said it. How do I know? You said I'm funny. Tell me what's funny.
We can't really talk about Goodfellas without talking about one of the most famous and one of the most memed scenes in the movie, perhaps in also in movie history. I'm talking, of course, about Joe Pesci's How Am I Funny scene. What's the origin story behind this?
The How Am I Funny scene came out of conversations that Scorsese had with Joe Pesci. Pesci talks about seeing a scene like that unfold in real life. He was a nightclub entertainer for a long time. He's a singer. He's a very good singer. So Joe Pesci in a nightclub experience where he witnessed, I don't know if he was on the actual receiving end of the harangue, but yeah, he did witness a mobster take umbrage at the notion that he was amusing and talk about how am I funny. And this was something they discussed prior, I think, even to Pesci taking the role. But again, it's part of the reason Pesci took the role is through discussion with Scorsese and saying to Scorsese, if I can make this my own, if I can make it special, I'd like to do it. And this is something Scorsese encourages with his actors, especially, you know, when they've got the ability to do it. Joe Pesci is not, in terms of his training as an actor, he's not on the level with Robert De Niro. But his instincts, his ear, his ability to recall situations and his ability to emotionally put himself in these extreme situations makes him as good as any, you know, very thoroughly trained performer.
There are several unforgettable shots and pans in Goodfellas, perhaps most famously Henry Hill and Karen's walk into the Copacabana. This was the work of Scorsese's director of photography, Michael Ballhaus. How did he and Scorsese collaborate to create these iconic scenes?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Ballhaus was a very good collaborative cinematographer. He was used to working under pressure because he had a long period under his belt of having worked with the German director, Rainer Werner Fassbinder, who was both a maniac and a genius, and who worked very, very fast. Fassbinder made almost 40 feature films and died at the age of 37 or something. So Ballhaus was used to that. He was used to working fast and getting great results by working fast. He was also very good, and Barbara DeFina, the producer, says this, Joe Reedy, the first assistant director, he's also very good at reassuring the director he was working for. Now, if you look at the scene, and this is a spoiler, but you see they really don't need to go in the kitchen. They actually go in a circle. Christy Z created a breakaway wall that blocks the entrance of the club when they go down and they make the left, and then that breakaway wall is slid back. They put some crates in front of the wall of the entrance to make it look a little different. And they literally go in a circle because, and this has to do with math and how the camera is recording two dimensions in a three-dimensional space and what the audience sees. They see the camera move, but they don't see the actual setting move or not move. So you don't notice it unless you look for it. But once you figure it out, you actually can unsee it. It works fine, but it's just a fun thing to take notice of.
Let's talk a little bit about the music in Goodfellas. Scorsese is one of the masters of using pop music to score films, and he even raised his own bar with Goodfellas. What was his philosophy about creating a soundtrack to this film?
The way he perceives things, he often talks about how he wants the viewer to see as he sees. And I think also he wants the viewer to hear the music in his head. All of the songs there are songs that, you know, he had these songs in his head well before the film even shot. There's a story how he's working on the script with Nick Pileggi, and during a scene at the bar where Robert De Niro's character, Jimmy, is trying to decide whether or not he's going to kill Maury, he wants a shot of him thinking about that, and he told Nick to put in parentheses on the margin of the page the word Cream. Pileggi told me, he said, you know, I'm a big Sinatra guy. I had no idea what he wanted that word there for. And it was because he wanted the song Sunshine of Your Love playing in the background. Now, how does he rationalize this? Because as he himself says, gangsters don't listen to psychedelic rock in the late 60s, early 70s. They were still listening to Jimmy Roselli and old songs from the old country. But they're in a bar. The bar has a jukebox. As long as he can come up with a rationale for it that, you know, hews to his sense of verisimilitude and reality, that's fine. But that's because in that scene, the song is coming out of the jukebox anyway. In the scene of Henry getting arrested, there's no source for where the music's coming from. It's all the music in Marty's head, but it's also the music in Henry's head. For instance, when he goes out in the morning and he thinks choppers are, you know, flying over his car. And there's one point where he's parked and he looks up at the sky and there's just this flash of blue sky and a little cloud. And there's just this snippet of Muddy Waters.
Everything gonna be all right this morning. Oh, yeah.
You know, and that's Henry's sense of relief that he doesn't see the chopper. Now, of course, the chopper comes back, and then the song, Mannish Boy, with its, you know, incredible stomping rhythm, comes back later in the sequence. But this is the soundtrack of the brain of the movie, and it's relentless during this scene. And then once the gun is put to his head at the very end of the scene, and he's arrested, there's no more music in the rest of the movie at all until the Sid Vicious My Way. And the Sid Vicious My Way, too, this kind of deflation of this ostensibly ennobling Frank Sinatra song. That was in Scorsese's head. Barbara DeFina says they were talking about it while Scorsese was shooting Last Temptation of Christ. That's how far back that idea comes from. So here, I think it's really working on all cylinders.
You mentioned the point where the music stops. And then the last, I think it is what, the last 35, 40 minutes, there's no more music until the Sid Vicious version of My Way over the end credits. Why did Scorsese choose that particular moment to stop using music?
Because that's where the fun stops. That's where it's over. You know, everything that happens after that is panic and deflation. Panic over the fact that Karen has thrown away the drugs that he was going to sell to mortgage his, you know, last stand. Mm-hmm. Deflation when he goes to see Paulie, and Paulie says, now I gotta turn my back on you.
But I got nowhere else to go, Paulie. You're all I've got, and I really, really need your help.
I really do. Take this. Now I gotta turn my back.
$3,200. That's what he gave me. $3,200 for a lifetime. Wasn't even enough to pay for the coffin.
It's arguably an on-the-nose metaphor. The music has stopped. The fun's over.
Yeah, the good times are over, yeah. What do you think about the way Scorsese uses voiceover in Goodfellas?
Oh, I think he's brilliant, and I think he uses it very well. And I've kind of revised my opinion about some use of voiceover in Scorsese overall. Voiceover is funny in Scorsese because he's not rigid about it. He has this freedom that I think he got from the influence of the French New Wave. People look at Goodfellas and they don't think, well, this is a movie that's had a big influence from Jules and Jim, the Truffaut movie. But it actually is. There's a huge Jules and Jim influence on that movie. And one of the things that I think Scorsese took from people like Truffaut is that you can kind of do anything you want, you know? You can do voiceover and then you can just drop it from the movie completely. To have Henry's voiceover is not sloppy writing. It's always underscoring a valid point that, you know, that the film's visuals get to. And it reveals a lot that the other portions of the film don't reveal.
This seemed like a perfect time in Glenn's answer about voiceovers to play a clip from Goodfellas to show what he was talking about.
Even before I first wandered into the cab stand for an after-school job, I knew I wanted to be a part of them. It was there that I knew that I belonged. And to me, it meant being somebody in a neighborhood that was full of nobodies. They weren't like anybody else. I mean, they did whatever they wanted. They double parked in front of a hydrant. Nobody ever gave them a ticket. In the summer, when they played cards all night, nobody ever called the cops. Must I
forever be? You get the feeling, you know, wow, you know, he loved these guys. And that's important. You know, he uses the voiceover incredibly constructively, and it definitely adds dimension.
Scorsese's longtime editor, Thelma Schoonmaker, edited Goodfellas. Can you talk a bit about...
Oh, boy, did she ever.
Yeah, can you talk a bit about Thelma and her editing style and philosophy?
She's more... Both Scorsese and Schoonmaker are primarily concerned with the emotional veracity of the moment as it's captured in the film, to the extent that they will sacrifice the convention of continuity in order to preserve it. And again, this is not a matter of indifference. She knows what she's doing. She knows when the cut doesn't match, and she's counting, Scorsese and Schumacher are counting on the fact that the emotional value of the moment will win out over this kind of continuity police type sensibility that a lot of people unfortunately now bring to their viewing of film.
30 years after it was made, how do you think Goodfellas holds up today?
Well, having watched it about 30 times over the course of writing the book, I have to say I still like it. It's a pantheon film. It has a lot of different qualities. It's appalling. It's funny. It's sometimes appalling and funny at the same time, which is hard to do. It does have a morality. But the morality is something you have to meet it halfway in order to really appreciate. And it does say something, I think, about the kind of mutated version of the American dream that being a mobster represents, and also about the permutations of capitalism and greed that I think still resonate today. But also the vividness of the movie. The thing that Scorsese does that too few filmmakers have, but is what we're always looking for in a movie, is the ability to put life on screen. And when I talk about putting life on screen, I'm not necessarily saying realism per se, because there's a lot of stuff in Goodfellas that's not realistic, that's, you know, heightened. But to put life on screen, to give it blood, to make it live, and to bring that life and to make you feel like you're living that life, you're experiencing that life, or that you have a connection to that life. I think Goodfellas is one of those movies where every frame has life in it, and it imparts that life to the viewer in a very specific and unusual way throughout its running time.
Glenn Kenny, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. I really had a great time speaking with you.
Glenn Kenny is a film critic and the author of Made Men, The Story of Goodfellas. As always, you can find even more at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Sharon Dolan, Stephen Graham Jones, and Glenn Kenny. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio, and let me tell you a bit about the guys behind the scenes. There was Stevie Petals Gotcher, who did our music and technical work.
He's a good earner, but he's crazy. He's a cowboy. He's got too much to prove.
And then there was this guy, executive producer Adam T. Times Friedrich, who got that nickname because he's always golfing.
I know what I'm doing. I've got things organized with these guys.
Then there was the rest of our mob, you Alphas. We'll see you next week. In the meantime, find other clowns to amuse you. I'm Dougie Menefergissimo Gordon. Be well.
Yeah.